You founded this company 12 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Tell them how old you were.
I was 19.
Don't worry about the future. We're in good hands.
Elizabeth Holmes was everything Silicon Valley and the media could hope for. A brilliant young female entrepreneur who dropped out of Stanford at the age of 19 to start a company called Theranos. Theranos promised to save people from pain and disease through early detection and lead the way into an era of cheaper, more consumer-driven healthcare. Theranos' big idea was to replace traditional venous blood draws in a doctor's office, hospital, or lab with simple finger pricks. One day, the company promised, patients would do the tests at home and then upload the results for their doctors. Holmes stacked her board of directors with establishment heavyweights such as George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, and General James Mattis, and she cozied up to Bill and Hillary Clinton. She also cashed hundreds of millions of dollars from investors that included the Walmart heirs, Rupert Murdoch and Betsy DeVos. For a time, her company was worth more than Spotify or Uber. But today, Theranos is on the verge of liquidation, and its backers have seen their investments completely wiped out.
We start off with that bombshell at Theranos. The Wall Street Journal reporting...
Holmes has been unmasked as a fraud and is now facing possible criminal charges. The man responsible for uncovering the truth about Theranos is John Carreyrou, a veteran investigative journalist at The Wall Street Journal. His dogged reporting revealed Holmes' tactics of flattery and intimidation that fooled investors and the press, allowing its founder to keep up the deception for as long as she did. When Carreyrou's stories on Theranos started appearing in October 2015, Holmes went on the offensive, depicting herself as a Silicon Valley disruptor who had become the target of a smear campaign orchestrated by established interests.
What do you think's going on here?
This is what happens when you work to change things. And first they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
With Carreyrou's reporting turning up one revelation after another and regulators finally cracking down, Holmes's public demeanor shifted.
I feel devastated that we did not catch and fix these issues faster.
Though she never went so far as to apologize to the thousands of patients whose health Theranos' product had put at risk. I sat down with John Carreyrou to talk about his new book on Theranos, Bad Blood, Secrecy and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, which has made the New York Times bestseller list and will soon be made into a movie starring Jennifer Lawrence as Elizabeth Holmes. Bad Blood raises tough questions about the failure of regulators to stop Theranos, the infatuation of the public and the press with the mystique of Silicon Valley, and the shadowlands where innovation, capitalism, and fraud sometimes get lost.
So what was Theranos, and who is Elizabeth Holmes?
Theranos is a diagnostics startup that was founded in 2003 in Silicon Valley by a young Stanford dropout named Elizabeth Holmes. She was midway through her sophomore year. She had this vision of a medical device that would test your blood. At first, it was an armband that would have these little microneedles that would prick your blood and diagnose what ailed you, and then simultaneously inject the appropriate drug. And so, in fact, the word Theranos was a combination of the words therapy and diagnosis. That original idea proved to be, more science fiction than anything that was really feasible. And she and her co-founder realized that pretty quickly. And so after a couple of months, they pivoted to what they wanted to build a device that was inspired from the portable glucose monitors that diabetes patients use to monitor their blood sugar. But Elizabeth wanted it to test all, to do all the lab tests known to man, which, was going to make it a lot more complicated and...
But a lot more exciting.
A lot more exciting, too, because the proposition was going to be that from a prick of blood from your finger, you'd be able to run all lab tests and you'd be able to do it quickly. The results would be accurate.
And do diagnostics on, various types of prescriptions and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it would be anywhere from several hundred to several thousand blood tests, ranging from the common blood tests that your doctor will prescribe just, to check up on how you're doing to tests to detect, certain types of cancers.
She was, 19 or 20?
She was 19 when she dropped out in late 2003.
And her role model was Steve Jobs. And she took to wearing, turtlenecks like Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was famous for, you know, what became known as the reality distortion field.
That, right.
Like, people in the room with him, you know, had to bow down to his magnetism and his charisma. A lot of people talked about Elizabeth Holmes in a similar way. What is the essential difference between Steve Jobs' ability to distort reality and Elizabeth Holmes?
Right. So Elizabeth did idolize Jobs. It was to the point that she started, as you mentioned, wearing black turtlenecks, and she wanted Theranos to fly an Apple flag, you know, at half mast the day that Steve Jobs died. She referred to him as Steve as if she had been best friends with him. She hired the same ad agency that Apple had used for some of its legendary ad campaigns. When she found out that that ad agency had met with Steve Jobs on Wednesdays, she decreed that she would have her meetings with the agency shy at day on Wednesdays. And as you say, she did share this trait, which is, like Jobs, she had this ability to sort of put a spell on people with her big blue eyes that blinked rarely, and this deep voice of hers.
Whenever there's a quote-unquote glass ceiling, there's an Iron Woman right behind it.
And also her intelligence. She's a very intelligent woman. I would say that the big difference and the reason why it was a fatal mistake for her to model herself after Jobs and Apple is that Apple was a computer company. Theranos was not a traditional tech company. It was actually a medical company, a healthcare company, because its device was a blood testing machine that patients and doctors were going to rely on and did rely on for a while for blood tests. And as Elizabeth said, at the height of her fame, 70% of medical decisions that doctors make are based on blood tests. When you're in the medical space, the medical realm, if you deliver a product that doesn't work, then lives are at stake.
Is there anything at all to her vision? Because, I mean, the way that it's played out, you know, there isn't. Theranos is near liquidation at this point, and we'll get to that. Is there anything to her vision of a cheap, you know, kind of portable, incredibly comprehensive, non-invasive blood testing technology?
Yeah. If she had been able to pull off, and if the company had been able to pull off what she claimed to have pulled off, I think it would have been an advance for medicine. It would have been a game changer to be able to draw, test so many analytes off just a small sample of blood, do it quickly, do it at a fraction of the price of competitors. She liked to say that because the test would be so user-friendly and painless and cheap that people would get their blood tested more often. And as a result, diseases would get diagnosed at an earlier stage.
No, it's a very appealing vision.
Right. And it's a logical one if the underlying technology exists and works. And the problem is that it never did at Theranos. And to this day, you know, when my first investigation came out in late 2015, a week or two later, she was at a conference and she said, "We're going to put out data soon, you know, disproving this reporter's reporting." And data, you know, never lies. And it was only in January of this year, January 2018, that Theranos finally published its first peer-reviewed paper in a scientific journal about the last iteration of its technology, the Minilab. And what was amazing about it is the study had been conducted with regular blood draws, with the old-fashioned way, with the big syringe. Moreover, it only covered a couple of blood tests, and some of the tests didn't agree with the results of conventional machines, which Theranos had to concede in the paper. And then last but not least, to run these various tests, Theranos had to configure the machine differently each time, because it still hadn't figured out how to fit all the instruments into one box. So this was a far cry from what she had promised as far back as September of 2013, when she went live with her fingerstick tests in Walgreens stores, first in Palo Alto and then in Arizona.
How did Holmes and her partners, the top-level people, keep this story alive? I mean, this beautiful dream of a kind of home lab where you would be able to, you know, be checking your blood, you know, almost like you're, you know, checking, you know, peeing on a strip or something like that.
Right.
How did they keep that hidden for so long?
Well, there was a culture of fear and intimidation at Theranos going back to its earliest days. Holmes actually sued some ex-employees in 2007. This culture got worse and was really enforced by her boyfriend, a man named Sonny Balwani, who was 19 years her senior and who's a guy who had made a lot of money during the internet boom. And he joined Theranos in late 2009 and really became the enforcer of this culture, a quasi-tyrant who silenced everyone and treated people badly, fired people all the time. In addition to Sonny, what you had also was you had David Boies as the company's outside counsel starting in 2011.
Boies, a legendary litigator who did Bush v. Gore,
right.
Who became a champion for gay marriage.
Right, and arguably the most famous and most feared lawyer in America, and he started working as outside counsel for Theranos in 2011, and he acted as a scarecrow for employees. They were afraid of him. They were afraid that if they spoke up either internally or after they left, went to the media or to regulators, that Theranos would come after them and sue them, and that David Boies, this great lawyer with a great track record who's also ruthless and feared, would be the one coming after them.
You mentioned Walgreens. Why did Walgreens, and there were other companies that bought into the vision or started using the services or trying them out, why did they buy in if this wasn't really working?
This is actually one of the craziest parts of the story is Walgreens did not do really any due diligence. It hired, as I explained in one chapter of the book, it hired a lab consultant named Kevin Hunter in 2010 when it began talking to Theranos. And Hunter's job was to vet the Theranos technology and help Walgreens decide whether to actually forge on with this partnership. And Hunter traveled several times to Palo Alto to meet with Elizabeth and Sonny. And he started smelling a rat early on, and he tried to alert the people who had hired him at Walgreens, and he just could not get through to them. They had this fear of missing out on the Theranos technology. They were obsessed with this notion that if they didn't pursue it, then Theranos would turn around and forge a deal with CVS, their arch rival based in Rhode Island. And so this fear of missing out drove Walgreens, amazingly, to ignore its own consultant.
How much of that is, it's fear of missing out, but then it's also the kind of lure and mystique of Silicon Valley, which is this shiny coastal bauble versus...
Right.
Being in a kind of 19th century business of retail,
right.
Of drugstores where, you're selling more and more as seen on TV,
right.
Stuff. Did that play
That played a role for sure. Walgreens is this stodgy, 100-year-old business based in Chicago, far from the razzle-dazzle of Silicon Valley. The thing that was a factor here also is Theranos had a major champion within the ranks of Walgreens executives. In the person of Jay Rosen, who was a trained doctor and who was absolutely head over heels for Elizabeth. He went by the nickname Dr. Jay. He liked to high-five people instead of shaking their hands, and he always introduced himself as, "Hi, I'm Dr. Jay, and I used to play basketball," which he thought was a hilarious joke. This guy was like a Silicon Valley groupie, and he managed to convince the CFO, the chief financial officer of Walgreens, to also get on board with the pilot. And the two of them really were big champions for this partnership.
The board of directors and kind of high-profile investors in Theranos, also kind of, an all-star cast, including people like George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, General Mattis. What role did that play? The cultivation of these kind of superstar hangers on.
This is something that Elizabeth did from the very beginning. She cultivated the backing of someone who was older, more experienced, and had a good reputation. The first person she did that with was Channing Robertson, her engineering professor at Stanford. He was a star of the Stanford School of Engineering, and he joined her board when she founded Theranos and accompanied her to pitch meetings with VCs. Then a year or two later, she met Donald L. Lucas, a well-known venture capitalist in Silicon Valley who groomed Larry Ellison, the Oracle founder, and helped him take Oracle public in the mid-80s. And then, unfortunately, Don Lucas started developing Alzheimer's disease in the 2010-2011 period. So she pivoted to George Shultz, the famous former Secretary of State who crafted the Reagan administration's foreign policy is credited by many as having won the Cold War. And
longstanding interest in kind of the pharma industry, drug legalization. I mean, he's an interesting, he's a great elder statesman who's widely respected.
Yes, and he lives, his house is right off the Stanford campus on Stanford land, and he's also passionate about science. And so when he met Elizabeth in 2011, he was immediately taken in by her, wowed by what she claimed her technology could do, joined her board, and then proceeded to introduce her to all his buddies at the Hoover Institution, the conservative think tank on the Stanford campus. And that's how she came to meet Henry Kissinger, Bill Perry, who had been Secretary of Defense under Clinton, Bill Frist, Sam Nunn, Admiral Roughhead. And pretty soon, all these guys were on the board, too. Elizabeth lured them with grants of stock. And you know, before you knew it, she had this board chock full of these amazing, you know, people with amazing resumes.
As I was reading the book and following the account, I mean, you know, the kind of feminist in me cropped up. I mean, like, because part of this, it just sounds like she is, you know, really working, like, I mean, in a kind of old screwball comedy or something. She's a femme fatale who is, like, wrapping her... you know, these guys around her finger. I mean, is that at work here?
Or? That was definitely at work. And I know, you know, it's pretty controversial to say this amid the Me Too movement. But, you know, the 15-year history of the company shows that that is what she did over and over again. These older men, you know, she wrapped them around her finger. She made them support her and believe in her. And I think she did it in part with her intelligence. She's very smart woman, and she did it with her charm. You know, she has these big blue eyes and she has this charisma, and they were kind of taken in. And you know, it ranges from Channing Robertson and Don Lucas at the beginning to Kissinger and then David Boies and Rupert Murdoch at the end of the story.
We're going to talk about Murdoch in a second, and this is a good time to bring up the press, because so, you know, you have companies like Walgreens buying in without doing due diligence. You have investors buying in without really understanding what's going on. You talk about how the first chief financial officer was like, you know, I don't really understand this, and it doesn't seem to be working, but I guess it does. I mean, like, there's that. The press was generally uncritical of her, and in many cases, they're the ones who kind of made her into an investment or a Silicon Valley superstar. Why did the press buy in? Isn't the I mean, the press is supposed to be the bulldog and the watchdog of democracy and of the market.
Well, she worked the press expertly. I mean, one thing that should be noted is the first mainstream publication that put her on the map was my newspaper, The Wall Street Journal. The editorial page of The Journal did a friendly interview with her in its Saturday edition in a column called The Weekend Interview. And this was back in September of 2013. And it coincided with the launch of Theranos fingerstick tests in Walgreens stores. And then the story, I would say, that really rocketed her to fame about 6 or 8 months later was the cover story in Fortune magazine that was published in June 2014. And she's shown, you know, with a black turtleneck and bright red lipstick. The headline, I think, is "This CEO is out for blood." And that was a really arresting photo. And it really made her a celebrity in Silicon Valley and beyond. That said, I don't blame the press too much, because people like Roger Parloff, who wrote that cover story, and then Ken Auletta, who wrote a long profile of Elizabeth Holmes 6 months later in The New Yorker, were outright lied to by her. I mean, you know, they were deceived.
Oh, but no, you're a reporter. You know, when your mother tells you she loves you, you check it out. I mean, Ken Auletta fits into this, you know, old man kind of getting
And Roger Parloff was a legal correspondent for Fortune, and Ken Auletta writes mostly about media and technology, not healthcare.
Right.
Neither of them had any expertise in medicine and certainly not laboratory science. Roger went and talked to all these larger-than-life board members and kind of used them to get corroboration that from them that she was the real thing. And all he heard from them was, you know, gushing words of praise. Yeah, I mean, I guess that they were really deceived, and they didn't necessarily go into those interviews and into those stories thinking that they should be on their guards about, you know, someone who was a pathological liar, which she was.
Is there any reason to believe that actual individuals died or were harmed by the rollout of Theranos?
It's very hard to get an answer to that question, because the correlation between, you know, someone having a bad health outcome and a blood test. It's very hard to scientifically prove it. That said, I came across more than a dozen examples of patients who'd gotten unreliable test results from Theranos. In most cases, luckily, their doctors were suspicious about these results and sent them, you know, to have their blood redrawn and retested elsewhere. One of the stories that I talk about in the book is that of a real estate agent in Phoenix who had a ringing in her ear. And so her doctor had sent her to Theranos to get her blood tested via finger stick. And her results came back, and I think six values came back abnormal. And the doctor, given the symptom, which was ringing in the ear, became very concerned that she was on the cusp of a stroke, and immediately sent her to the emergency room. The patient spent 4 hours in the hospital and underwent a battery of tests. Finally, the hospital ran her labs again, and they were normal. She then had more tests, MRIs, over the ensuing week until she and her doctor finally came to the conclusion that the Theranos tests had been inaccurate. So that gives you an idea of the health scare that this company put some people through.
You had mentioned Rupert Murdoch in passing. You work for the Wall Street Journal, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch or by his corporation. There's a story in there when you started writing about Theranos and you started uncovering a lot of weirdness going on and a lot of, you know, dicey things. Talk a little bit about what happened. Murdoch was an investor in Theranos.
Right.
Simultaneously, you know, owned the newspaper there, controlled the newspaper you were writing for. And there comes a moment where Theranos goes to Murdoch and puts the screws to him. Does Rupert Murdoch, does Sir Murdoch or what Lord Murdoch acquit himself well?
I mean, I would say that in the end he does. When I started digging into Theranos in early February 2015, he was a month away or 3 weeks away from investing $125 million, which he proceeded to do. I had no idea that he was an investor. He had no idea that I was working on an investigation of the company. And the first I heard a vague rumor that he might be an investor a couple days before we went to print with my first story. Wasn't able to confirm that. And then heard rumors sporadically in the following months and year. Was never able to confirm those rumors. Finally, a year after my first story was published, as I went on book leave to write this book, I was able to confirm with a source that not only was he an investor, but he was the single largest investor. He had put in $125 million into the company, which stunned me. And I also learned shortly thereafter that she had had several meetings with him, one at Theranos headquarters in Palo Alto a couple months before my story was published, in which she brought up my story and said that I had gathered a lot of damaging and false information and that it shouldn't be published. She hoped he would kill it. And then again, just 2 weeks in late September, just 2 weeks before we went to press with my story, and that time it was in the News Corp building on the 8th floor where Murdoch had his office. And I was on the 5th floor working on the story, and I had no idea she was in the building.
Where were the regulators in all of this? Because it is a healthcare company, because it's drawing blood, et cetera. There's a vast array of, you know, this isn't the Wild West or anything. Who were the regulators and where were they in all of this?
Well, just like she played the press, she really played regulators. So you have two health regulators that are involved in regulating the lab industry. You have the FDA, which reviews and approves the laboratory equipment that laboratories buy and use in their labs. And then you have the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which not many people know, aside from running the Medicare program, has a second job, which is to be the overseer of clinical laboratories in this country. And it does that by doing inspections every 2 years and by having labs do this thing called proficiency testing. Basically, what she did was she navigated a gray area between these two regulators, and she maintained that her tests, the Theranos tests, were what are called laboratory developed tests, which are not tests run on commercial machines that have been approved by the FDA. They're tests that are fashioned by labs with their own methods. And that's a part of the lab business that hasn't been closely regulated or policed. And the FDA, for a while, was beginning to make noise about wanting to police police it more aggressively. That's now changed under the Trump administration. But so she really drove a truck through this loophole. At the same time, she paid lip service to the fact that she was voluntarily submitting each of her proprietary tests to the FDA. That turned out to be in part her undoing because after she submitted data for a few of these finger stick tests, my sources at the FDA told me that the data actually didn't look good. Mm. And aside from hearing from me, because I was running by an FDA source of mine, what I was learning in my reporting, trying to figure out if it was allowed. And so the FDA was concerned by what it was hearing from me, but it was also concerned by the clinical data it had received from Theranos and decided it should inspect the company and see if it could find any better data on site. And it turned out that they did inspect, they couldn't find any better data. And they said, you know, we better shut this down because these tests are going to be inaccurate and unreliable.
In the large scheme of things, you know, in reading the book and following the story, you know, I'm kind of torn between two interpretations. One is that, you know, is this a case of kind of market failure in the sense that it went on for so long and it got, you know, a lot of money? I mean, it hosed, you know, Rupert Murdoch for over $100 million. It skated around regulations, which I can kind of understand. I'm a good libertarian. I get that. You know, they capture the, or, you know, you work around that. Is it market failure in the sense that it took so long to come out, or is it kind of market success because it did unravel because of all of the different institutions in a kind of market system? What's the kind of big disposition of this story?
I think it's market failure in one key way, which is that Walgreens was a key linchpin here, an enabler in the sense that it helped Theranos commercialize the blood tests and make them available directly to patients. And Walgreens, you would think, would have done its due diligence and would have vetted the technology and incomprehensibly did not do so. And because of Walgreens' failure to vet and to do due diligence, she was able to go live with the technology and then in late 2013 approach investors and say, look, obviously my product is for real and I've really done what I am saying I've done because, you know, we're offering the service in Walgreens stores. Walgreens wouldn't be letting us do this if it weren't real and if the tests weren't accurate. And that suckered in investors like Partner Fund Management, the San Francisco hedge fund that put in almost $100 million. And it suckered in the other billionaire investors, the likes of Rupert Murdoch, Betsy DeVos and her family, which put in $100 million. The Coxes, which control Cox Enterprises in Atlanta, put in $100 million. The Waltons, the heirs of Sam Walton, who founded Walmart. They put in $150 million via two investment vehicles. And they were, in large part, sold on the investment by the notion that the product was already commercialized.
What is the lesson for the press, do you think, as well as consumers of the press? You know, whether or not you're in a position to invest $100 million in something, you know, what do reporters or what do media people and consumers of media need to take away from this story?
To me, it's not just the media and consumers of the media. It's really American society at large. We've come to deify these young, you know, college dropouts who found these startups in Silicon Valley and attract a lot of funding and pretty soon become these unicorns, you know, which is the term that's been coined to describe companies, private companies that have reached a valuation of $1 billion or more. Theranos, by the way, achieved at its peak a valuation of $10 billion. And for a couple months there, it was more valuable than Uber, Airbnb, and Spotify. Not many people realize that. I think the lesson is that these are, in the end, these are just young kids. You know, we've turned them into these icons and these heroes, and they've become what, you know, our children aspire to be when they come out of college and graduate school. And I think the Theranos scandal should make us re-examine this whole value system.
Final point, what is Elizabeth Holmes up to? And you play out the final weeks of Theranos.
Right, so she's essentially now turning the lights off. She laid off another 100 employees about a month and a half ago. So the headcount of the company is down to about 20 employees. That same day, she sent out an email to investors explaining that the cash level of the company was going to drop below $3 million this summer. at which point the private equity firm Fortress will be able to seize Theranos' assets and liquidate it. So we're very likely looking at a liquidation of Theranos as a company by August. The company will have ceased to exist by then. And I hear from my sources that Elizabeth is telling people, even though she's been charged with fraud by the SEC and she has settled those charges without admitting or denying wrongdoing, she's telling people she's going to start a new company. I think the odds of that happening are pretty low because a lot of people forget there's been a second investigation going on, a criminal one. It's been spearheaded by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. It's 2.5 years old at this point. It's very advanced. And I think criminal indictments of Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani, her ex-boyfriend, are a distinct possibility.
Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with John Carreyrou, who is the Wall Street Journal reporter and the author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.